MacCast, Wednesday, December 4th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We got some cool stuff to talk about this week. Well, I guess some cool stuff and maybe some things that Apple isn't too happy about. We're going to get into some new technology that they've been acquiring. They've been buying some more companies. We have some information on that. Also, the iPad mini with a Retina display may not be the display you're looking for, at least according to some. And I have a little update on some stuff that's going on with our friends at Smile. We've got all that plus a bunch of great feedback. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into that iOS storage thing. I got some great feedback from you on that. And also I've got some helpful Safari shortcuts as well as some info on do-it-yourself iPhone repairs. All of that and a lot more coming right up. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. I've been telling you about Lynda.com for the last few episodes. I love having them as a sponsor because I actually love their product. Lynda.com, for those of you who don't know, is a site. They offer really high quality video courses, training. You can learn any kind of creative software, business skills. They have an extensive catalog that really covers a big, broad range of topics. You really kind of have to go there and check it all out. There's over 2,000 different courses, and they're adding new courses all the time. And the quality of their instructors, the people they get to put these things together, is just amazing. You'll recognize a lot of big names on that list. And you can actually search by author. You can search by subject, software. They make it real easy to get in there and find the stuff that you're looking for. So even though they have all that content, you can really drill down and get at the kind of training that you need. And it's not just about learning software. There's actually tons of great courses that cover techniques, things like getting the perfect photo or video. So all of that stuff before you even sit down in front of a computer. And as a matter of fact, I looked around, I found some great lessons on helping get the perfect photo from your digital SLR, how to set up location lighting on a video shoot. And so what I'd really like you to do is just check out the content. And to do that, they're giving you a free trial. You get free trial access to the entire library just by going to lynda.com/MacCast. And I even had them update the MacCast playlist. So when you go to that lynda.com/MacCast page, there's a little link there. It says MacCast playlist or Adam's playlist, I don't remember specifically. Click on that and it will show you these new video and photo courses that I found, along with all of the OS X Mavericks courses. I have some iLife and iWork courses in there as well, I think. So a bunch of stuff to get you started, and that trial membership lets you get access to everything. So you can look at those, you can browse through those to get you started, and then just go through the whole entire catalog. And when you're ready to sign up, they have full access plans starting as low as $25 a month. So it's affordable for really high quality training. I mean, you go to a conference, you're going to spend a lot more than you will at lynda.com, and I think you're going to learn more on lynda.com. So just head over to lynda.com/MacCast. There you'll find out all the details about the service, the various plans that they offer. All that information is there. That's lynda.com/MacCast. I think you're really going to like it. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. If you were listening last week or you were following the blogs, you know that Apple recently acquired technology from the entire company, PrimeSense, which is a motion sensor technology company. And there's been a lot of speculation about what Apple might use that technology for. The most common theory seemed to be that they would use it for motion control interfaces in an update to the Apple TV or in the full Apple branded television, maybe also possibly bringing the technology to the EyeSight camera on your Mac or maybe even in your iOS device. But a technology journalist, Jessica Lesson, had a different theory this week. She put a post up on her blog, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But she throws out this interesting theory with some details to back it up. She says that the motion sensor technology that PrimeSense has really isn't the current state of the art, and that is possibly one reason why Microsoft stopped using it in their Xbox Kinect product. So originally, PrimeSense helped Microsoft develop the Xbox Kinect, their motion control system for the Xbox, but they moved away and started doing their own thing. But what the company does have is it has a chip that can use camera systems to actually map out environments in full 3D. And there are already some mapping companies using that technology, using those chips from PrimeSense. And we also know that Google's already been kind of moving indoors with their mapping efforts. And so this could be, the theory is, Apple could be looking to get ahead in terms of their own indoor kind of mapping. And you start to combine this with some of Apple's other technologies, things like iBeacons, and you get some really interesting ideas sort of floating around in your head. Also, we know that Apple lost Street View, which a lot of people really like. We have Flyover, but think if Apple could bring walkthrough technology into Apple Maps, and they could potentially use these chips and maybe iOS devices. I'm theorizing here. I'm sort of expanding on Jessica's piece, just thinking outside the box. They could potentially crowdsource the gathering of that data if they can get PrimeSense chips and technology built into iSights. So I may be able to walk into a space and, hey, there's not an interior 3D mapping of that space. Maybe I can take out my iPhone or iPad and capture that, send that data back to Apple, obviously on an opt-in basis, and then they could use that to help build out their system. So imagine you're sort of at a mall and you ask Siri to find a specific store, and she can give you literally 3D walking directions, a 3D photorealistic map that you can sort of be guided through with overlays, even showing directions to go, which way to turn, maybe even contextual information, maybe even marketing information. They could throw up coupons and things for different stores as you walk by that storefront right there on your device. It gets really, really interesting. And same sorts of things could be done for museums and cities, walking tours, all that kind of stuff. So it's an interesting thought and really adds a lot more value to Apple's acquisition of the company. And my guess is that they would use the PrimeSense technology for all these kinds of applications and a whole lot more. So I think they would still use the sensor technology, maybe for motion control systems, maybe to enhance gaming in iOS and Apple TV. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could use and put this technology to work with. And remember, it's the people within PrimeSense that came up with all these ideas and the technology itself. So Apple also has added them as part of their human resources portfolio. So just gaining the talent that these companies have can be critical for Apple. And I've commented a couple times, you know, Tim Cook seems to really believe that sensors and sensor technology is going to be a big part of products in the future. So I think Apple's looking to find innovative companies to kind of build up that portfolio. I've never actually been there, but I've heard that Apple products are actually very popular in Brazil. And one of the reasons why Apple, I think, put a factory in Brazil was to kind of bring down costs. It's always been complained about in the region that Apple products are extremely, extremely expensive. I guess they're also being priced, at least when it comes to iTunes content, being priced in US dollars, which is a little bit weird. I think the Brazilian government thinks it's not only weird, they think it might be potentially illegal. We're getting a story this week that Brazil wants Apple to switch pricing in iTunes from the US dollar to their local currency, which is called the real. Apparently, Apple charges Brazilians in US dollars on iTunes and has been doing that since 2011. And according to everything I'm reading, it's illegal in the country to do that. So the Brazilian Consumer Protection Secretariat Department has given Apple 10 days to explain why they're charging in US dollars versus Brazilian dollars. And if Apple doesn't respond, they could face fines of up to 6 million real, which is about $2.6 million. My guess is that Apple will respond pretty quickly. I read this story a couple days ago, so I think they have a few more days to respond. And the answer is likely going to be they'll just switch over to posting pricing or having the pricing in real, of course, converting up from US dollars, from the US dollar equivalent. I don't know if they'll add additional sort of fees for the exchange sort of stuff. It gets tricky when Apple is in different regions to figure out how they handle pricing, because you also have local and regional taxes and a bunch of other stuff that gets kind of tacked on. So it makes it really hard to do direct one-to-one comparisons on pricing. But my assumption is that's how they would respond to this, is just simply, all right, we'll change the system over. I don't know how technically difficult that is, but I can't imagine, since they do it in other countries in local currency. The real question I have is, why were they doing it in U.S. dollars in the first place? I went to my local Apple retail store a couple weeks ago to go in and check out the new iPad minis with Retina display. As you know, if you've been listening to the show, I was flip-flopping on whether or not I was actually going to buy one for myself. I absolutely love my iPad mini. I love the size. I love the form factor. And the idea of being able to get a gorgeous Retina screen finally on that device is really, really appealing. But I also bought an iPad Air, and for me, that seems to be the perfect iPad for the moment. But I still wanted to go in and get a look at this new Retina display to be able to do a comparison side by side with the older iPad mini. And luckily, when I went into the Apple retail store, they had them there right next to each other, because Apple is still selling the version without a Retina display. So I was able to take them, put them side by side, and as expected, that Retina display is gorgeous. The resolution is absolutely fabulous. In terms of color and all those other things, at least in the Apple retail store, I know it's kind of a bright environment, but I couldn't tell a difference. It looked to be exactly the same quality as the prior generation, which got rave reviews and from many of the testing sites was said to be one of the best displays on the market. But apparently that was 2 years ago, because we've been hearing reports of people saying that the iPad mini Retina display is not up to snuff with some of its competitors. And this week, DisplayMate was out with their comparisons of the latest 7 and 8 inch tablet displays, and they compared the iPad mini with Retina display against the Kindle Fire HDX 7 and the new Nexus 7. And in their opinion, the iPad was the least, I don't want to say this, I don't want to say worst of the three. It was the worst of the three, but the least good. They are all good displays, I guess is what I'm getting at. But they felt that the other two really beat out Apple's latest display in terms of quality. And the failure seems to be in Apple's choice of display technology, at least according to the DisplayMate study. The iPad mini with Retina display actually comes in two different kinds of technology. There's the IGZO that we've been hearing about, and also the older amorphous silicon panels. And Apple is using both technologies probably to keep up with demand. And so the technology, according to the report, at least with the IGZO displays, is about 2 years old and really doesn't hold up when pitted against these new technologies that Samsung and Amazon are employing in their devices. So surprisingly, it's the Kindle that comes out on top this time around. And that's surprising, because in the past, the Kindle was the third place finisher, often behind the Samsung and devices and the iPad. The thing is the Kindle has now been bumped up to use a brand new technology, something called quantum dots. And according to the report, this increases the gamut range by 40-50% while still being 10-20% more efficient. Now, the Samsung panels, they're using a different newer technology, something called low temperature polysilicon, LTPS technology, and that also dramatically increases the color gamut available to the display. As a matter of fact, both of these display technologies actually give close to, if not beyond, the full standard color gamut, whereas Apple's panels apparently are currently only able to reproduce about 63% of the standard color gamut. And it's too bad, because Apple's displays really were the ones that had the best color gamut range a few years ago, but that's really kind of the point that we're getting at here, right? The one thing that I did wonder was, how is Apple actually able to use two different technologies, display technologies, but still maintain a consistency between different iPad minis? Because they didn't tell you on the side of the box, oh, this one is an IGZO panel and this one's an amorphous silicon panel. The consumer doesn't really know, But, you know, how can you really kind of test these things and have them be standardized? And the article went into that as well. So they said that Apple is using more expensive white LEDs in their amorphous silicone panels. And the reason is that gives them or lets them draw less power and compensates for the fact that the amorphous silicone panels actually use higher power consumption than the comparable IGZO panels that Apple's using. So between that and a lot of the factory calibrations and things that Apple does, which they've already always done a really great job with, I guess that's how they get this sort of consistency, not only in the panels themselves, but also in terms of battery life, because the two technologies really draw different amounts of power and require a little bit larger batteries and what have you, at least according to the DisplayMate report. And so where the iPad mini with Retina display panel really fell down was in this color gamut, this color accuracy testing or brightness. I guess gamut's really the range. It's not necessarily the accuracy. The colors were accurate on the iPad display within the gamut that it's able to display, but the gamut is dramatically increased with the newer technologies. And the piece also points out, kind of adding insult to injury on Apple, that the IGZO technology is also widely considered to be the thing that has been giving Apple yield issues, slowing the number of iPad minis they've actually been able to get into the market. So it sort of raises the question, why is Apple relying on this older technology that's kind of giving them issues? What they don't mention or point out is what kind of yield rates you can get using the two new technologies, the LTPS and this technology that Amazon is using. And we know those companies are producing less units potentially than Apple needs to produce. So that may have factored into Apple's decision to kind of stick with some of the older technologies that where they might have more options for suppliers and factories and things like that that are producing those kinds of panels. So we don't have a lot of details behind sort of Apple's decision. So it's kind of hard to pass judgment because really at the end of the day, overall, all three of these panels, all of these displays are actually really, really good, and the Mini did quite well. As a matter of fact, it beat the other two tablets out in terms of contrast, and it also offered a superior color gamma, so more natural colors, better in the gamma range, I think. And overall, it scored well for resolution, had low color shift at off viewing angles, low reflectivity, good performance in high ambient light. So there were a lot of good things to be said about the Apple panel. I think the thing to remember when you're reading these reports and things like that is companies like DisplayMate, they test displays at very precision, scientific levels in lab environments. They're looking at things in a way that consumers don't. They're using machines to measure levels and compare numbers. It's really benchmarking. And just like with benchmarking in, say, CPUs, it's really the real world performance tests and comparisons that matter to most consumers. Most consumers can't see the kinds of things that get tested in benchmarks, but what they can do is they can feel, hey, this one's faster than the last one I had, or the photos on this one look better than the photos on that one. Those sorts of things really matter. And for that, the iPad mini with a Retina display is getting really high marks. The reviews have been fabulous. Everybody loves the new panel. So I think for Apple, that's really what matters most. It's consumers and how happy they are with the product. So it's not that the iPad mini with a Retina display is a bad product. Again, all of these panels are some of the best quality displays that have been put out on the market to date. It's just that Apple might need to start looking to future technologies for their display technology, something that they've always typically done. So it's an odd move for Apple because they're usually on the cutting edge. Now they've been leapfrogged, but this is the game, right? One company leapfrogs the other, and maybe next time around, Apple will jump ahead and they'll be on top of the latest and greatest display technology. But we're going to have to wait till new iPads come out next year before we know. It's looking like, now that we have some reports on how Black Friday went, that Apple's Friday was maybe a little bit darker shade than some other retailers and companies. The shopping day after Thanksgiving, for those who don't know, is typically known as Black Friday. Kind of hard to avoid, especially if you're in the United States. I don't know how it goes in other countries, if you have Black Friday or if that's just strictly a U.S. consumerism kind of thing. The idea being is it's the day that retailers offer really big incentives, have really big sales and discounts to kind of drive yearly profits, moving them from being in the red into the black to becoming profitable. I think in many respects, it's mostly symbolic more than an actual reality. But regardless, many industry watchers keep a close eye on consumer behavior and buying and what happens over that weekend. And this year, it looks like Apple did particularly well. Folks apparently used their Apple devices more than any other devices to actually do their Black Friday shopping. This is according to a report over on TechCrunch. They said iOS devices counted for almost a third of e-commerce sales, coming in at 28% of purchases made on iOS devices. In comparison, Android devices were used by about 11% of online shoppers. Another report said that Black Friday purchases made by Android device owners were actually often for Apple products. InfoScout tracked retail tablet purchases, and their data indicated that about 40% of iPad purchases made on Black Friday were actually made by Android device owners. I guess InfoScout has a little application that lets you earn points and get credit for your purchases, and you do it by snapping pictures with your phone. So my guess is that they had receipts for iPads that were taken with Android phones. So I don't know if that's a direct correlation to that 40%. You might be drawing a little bit of a conclusion. Some of those things could have been gifts, but still people owning Android devices buying iPads, which is an interesting thing to look at. But there's certainly no doubt that the iPad was a hot seller on Black Friday in that post-holiday rush, probably due to large gift card incentives that a number of retailers, folks like Walmart and Target, were giving specifically on iPads. They say, both Walmart and Target say, that the 16-gigabyte iPad Air was the top in-store seller on Black Friday, and by a pretty good margin. Analysts and stock watchers also seemed to like what they saw in Apple's retail performance over the weekend. Many raised their price targets on Apple's stock, and the Apple stock had a nice climb since Black Friday. I haven't had a chance to look at it today or late yesterday to see how it's doing, but Apple stock has been on a little bit of an upswing as of late, and likely due to some of these retail numbers that have been coming out. So most of the reports I was seeing were about the iPad. This isn't specifically Black Friday related, but it looks like the iPhone 5C has an interesting new market. The iPhone 5S, we know, has been outselling Apple's iPhone 5C by about 3-to-1, and that was again confirmed for October in a report from Kantar WorldPanel ComTech. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the iPhone 5C is a bust. Their numbers are also showing that it's kind of doing the job I think it was set out to do. This latest study for October shows that more price-sensitive buyers are going for the iPhone 5C, and almost half of those buyers are actually switching from competitive products. About 80% of iPhone 5S owners are upgrading their Apple devices, but on the 5C side, those sales are mostly going to owners of Android and other kinds of smartphones. Overall, Apple's smartphone market share for October has gone up, and they've had their best showing in the U.S. and Japan, according to the study, about 52.8% market share in the U.S. and a staggering 76.1% in Japan. That's likely spurred on by Apple finally getting the iPhone on Japan's largest carrier, NTT Docomo. So they're doing really well in those countries. Still, though, globally, Android phones are doing better than Apple in a lot of specific reasons. Inland Europe and China, Android devices account for about 70%. So overall, the iPhone is doing well. It's given a nice bump to Apple sales. I think they're getting a really nice bump from brand new iPad models being out this holiday season. Actually, a full lineup and range of products being out this holiday season. I fully expect that when Apple announces its first quarter numbers, that they're going to be really, really big. So I guess we're just going to have to wait on those. But I don't think anybody should be worrying about Apple. And certainly with the stock price going up, I don't think Wall Street is. Now, I normally don't cover non-Apple updates on the show, but this time around, I am going to make an exception because Smile, MacCast sponsor and makers of the awesome Text Expander, among other great apps, was recently forced by Apple to change how they do their snippet sharing functionality in Text Expander Touch, and more specifically, how snippets can get shared between different applications that have implemented their Text Expander Touch APIs. Since Apple's never kind of allowed a centralized place for apps to be able to put and share data, and since apps like Text Expander Touch are sandboxed from running in any kind of way that can kind of integrate with other iOS applications, Smile has always found really clever and smart ways to get their stuff to work within Apple's defined ecosystem. They're very careful about how they implement this stuff to try and not run afoul of anything that Apple is doing or requiring of them. And as a matter of fact, for Text Expander Touch, they did some creative things like built this API that they could give to developers to roll into their applications, basically adding in Text Expander functionality into the app itself. And the only thing that was happening kind of outside the app was it was getting the snippets that you use from a centralized location. And for that, most recently, they were sharing the snippet data using the Reminders application. So they would actually store the data in a reminder that was just set to a date really, really far in the past. So all the data was in there, and apps within the App Store guidelines are allowed to access data and information that's inside Reminders. So like I said, very smart, very clever way to handle this. Well, recently, Smile was notified and Apple told them that they needed to stop using that workaround. They put the kibosh on that. And so Smile is being forced to change the way that snippet sharing works between applications and works with their APIs. And what that means is that applications that are using Text Expander Touch will now require user interaction to actually get snippet data. You're going to have to implicitly tell it to go get the snippet data, and those applications are going to need to store their own copy of that data. So every application that has Text Expander Touch integration is now going to have a copy of that data. It's this classic, you know, sort of how Apple does everything with iCloud and applications. Everything kind of has its own copy, its own little piece of the data. You know, part of that's for security and sandboxing, but it gets really, really inconvenient. It also means that when you want to update your snippets, so if I update them on my Mac and I have them sync over to Dropbox, every app is going to have to sync up that data as well. I think it has to make some sort of HTTP call back. I'm not entirely sure how all the technology works. Maybe we can get Smile on to actually kind of explain it to us. But the point is that each app, what it means to you and me is each app has to get and update the data on its own, and it's going to require more interaction. It's not going to be this sort of seamless process anymore. Hardly ideal, but it actually meets Apple's guidelines. But that means that all of the applications that integrate with Text Expander Touch are also going to need to be updated in order to use this sort of new snippet sharing system that they've put in place. So Smile is maintaining a list of updated applications for iOS 7 on their website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Hopefully it grows quickly. They've always had great support from others in the developer community. Those people have implemented Text Expander Touch in their application, so I expect that to happen pretty rapidly. But I don't know what that means for the short term of those of us who use and rely on Text Expander Touch in our applications. I guess we're going to have to wait for those app updates to come out before we can get snippets all syncing up and being happy again. And that's a bummer, you know, but it's just the way it is. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple has bought another company, or at least we've noticed that Apple has bought another company. I probably should not lead off these things that way, because it's going to become this sort of thing where I say every week, hey, Apple's bought another company. Apparently, at least according to Apple, they buy smaller companies all the time. More recently, it seems like the media has been on top of when Apple acquires these new companies. And this time around, oddly, it's a social media company. So let's really hope that Apple's not planning on bringing back Ping 2.0. Anybody? No? I don't see anybody raising their hand for that one. The purchase was confirmed by Apple. The company is called Topsy Inc. And what it does is social media analytics. So basically, it allows companies and others to search and track how specific brand names, products, keywords, things like that are used on social media sites like Twitter. And reportedly, the price for the purchase, Apple Insider says it was more than $200 million. Apple never comments on the specific details of these acquisitions. But as for why Apple might want it, there is some theories floating around. The acquisition would give Apple access to apparently some Twitter data that's normally not available to other companies, including their competitors. The Wall Street Journal reported that Topsy is one of four what's called certified data resellers for Twitter, meaning they have exclusive rights to collect and resell a lot of raw Twitter data, data that's normally not available to the public. And the question I would have for this, and I didn't see the details in the Wall Street Journal report, but the one question I have is, would the terms of Apple's agreement to purchase Topsy, would that also transfer the agreement that they had in place with Twitter, or would Apple lose that in the buyout? Hopefully they thought about that as part of the deal going into it. I'm sure their lawyers are smarter than I am and very likely did. But I remember in the past, Apple's had some acquisitions, I think specifically when they acquired, and shoot, I'm not going to remember the name of the company, but they acquired a music company that gave them access, or that had an agreement in place where they could have longer song previews, I think 90 seconds, and Apple was doing 60-second ones. And it wasn't clear whether Apple, that licensing was going to transfer over. As a matter of fact, I don't think it did. I think Apple had to go back and renegotiate that licensing even after acquiring the company and their technology. So hopefully this time around, that was all kind of handled up front. Of course, Apple's not saying how they plan to use the technology, but the conclusion among most people are that, you know, it'll give Apple access to a lot of this social trending data to use in their products and services. So a lot of it's probably going to be focused on search and recommendations and things like that. The actual applications can then return more accurate, relevant information based on this additional data coming into sort of the data stream, these social trends. So think of possibilities for Apple products like Siri, Maps, iAds, iTunes Radio, those sorts of things. Siri could suddenly adjust or enhance results based on Twitter trends of maybe people that you follow or you're interested in, or if you're actually asking about a specific product or something like that, then that could factor into kind of the results, the algorithm for returning results. If you think about iTunes music recommendations or app recommendations, it could factor in that data and information coming from Twitter on what the most popular apps of the moment are. So if there's a particular app that's kind of hot and trending, it could potentially see that in this Twitter data and factor that into recommendations on the iTunes store or the App Store, things like that. If you're looking for a particular song, it could kind of filter out maybe results that aren't accurate based on that information. So it's a lot about this age that we're in. You know, whatever Apple plans for the age of big data, all this information coming in, having any kind of tools that allow them to analyze, pare down, apply the data and information to give better results, more accurate results, more relevant results to us, that's going to be a good thing for any company to have. So looks like another good pickup and acquisition on Apple's part. And hopefully they can figure out how to roll and merge all of this technology into their own and give us ultimately better products and services and things like that. I mean, that's the end goal, I think, for all of this stuff. So that's an easy conclusion to draw. What the specifics are, those get a little more minute. But that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before I move on, let me take another quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's Gazelle. You know, the holidays are coming, and I'm guessing you may have a shiny new Apple device on your wish list, maybe two or three or four, if you're like me. Actually, I think I have everything I need. No, that's not true. I would love a new iMac, maybe a new MacBook Pro. Yeah, the list goes on and on and on. We all have it, right? But the question is, once you get your new one, what are you going to do with the old one? Or maybe ahead of time, you want to get some funds for that new Apple product. Well, Gazelle.com actually wants to buy your old gear. They want to buy your old stuff and they want to give you cash for it. And that's cash you could use toward that purchase or maybe to recoup some of the money that you spent. Take a little sting out of the holiday drain on your wallet. And the process could not be easier. All you have to do is go over to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Find your item and then tell Gazelle a little bit about the condition. They'll even buy broken iPhones. And you get a risk-free offer for your gadget within minutes. And they even give you free shipping. And once you send in your item, you can get paid fast by check, by PayPal. You can even opt for an Amazon gift card, and they give you an extra 5% on your offer when you do that. So it's a really good deal. I've been using Gazelle for years. I actually sold my iPhone 4 and 4S to help fund my iPhone 5 purchase. And it was great to have that money to kind of recoup and get it back. And I really just, my big thing about the service is how easy they make the whole process. They sent me a box. I opted for that option. They sent me the shipping labels. It was really easy to pack up. They show you everything that you need to do. You send it in, and within a short amount of time, I had the money in my Amazon account. I went for the Amazon option because I'm a huge fan of Amazon Prime. But check it all out. You can get details on their website at gazelle.com. So you get fast payments, typically within a few days of receiving your item. They will wipe your data for free. You can wipe it yourself before you send it in, but they also go through a process to clean that off. And they have a great reputation. They've paid out more than $100 million to over 600,000 customers. And I know many of you are customers of Gazelle, and I've gotten great emails from people who talk about their great customer support and service. If there is any issue, you can get a hold of somebody. They resolve things very, very quickly, and I think they're just a really great service, really great company. So I want you to check them out, gazelle.com. Head there, get an offer on your old devices now, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. On the last show, you may remember that I went into pretty good depth on why there's some discrepancies in storage capacities on an iOS device between the stated capacity of the device and the actual amount of available storage when you go in and you look at the usage data. And I received a number of comments and follow-ups after that show, emails from you, and I learned a little bit more about why there is this confusion between the sizes of our devices and how much storage appears to be available. Now, the gist of it comes down to how many bytes you count as being in a gigabyte, right? We have 64 gigabyte, 32 gigabyte, 16 gigabyte devices. And it turns out there's actually kind of two different ways that a gigabyte can be interpreted. And the definition is different, I guess now what I understand from hearing from some of you, different depending upon what kind of thing that you're talking about, what kind of storage media you're talking about, most specifically whether you're talking about RAM or you're talking about storage. And so these two different methods are base 10, like a decimal system, and base 2, or a binary system. And in base 10, 1 gigabyte equals 1 billion bytes. And this is actually the system that's recommended by the International System of Units and also the International Electrotechnical Commission, the IEC. And it's the standard that was adopted pretty much by the storage industry. So if you have a hard drive or you have a flash-based device, its capacity is calculated using this base 10, 1 gigabyte equals 1 billion bytes method. And then on the other side, you have base 2, or the binary method, where 1 gigabyte is 1,073,741,824 bytes. So you got more bytes using the binary system. And this is typically used in RAM storage. And it's also found in many operating systems. Many OSs, including iOS, uses this method to do its calculation. So like we explained in the last show, Apple uses the base 10 method to determine how they advertise the capacity of their products, because That's the storage, right? And they're using the storage standard. So they use the base 10, but then iOS turns around and uses this base 2 method when reporting and displaying the amount of storage. Apple actually has a support article on their website that goes into and kind of explains this. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But that's why on an iOS device, 32 gigabytes of storage actually appears. So if you buy a 32 gigabyte iPhone or iPad, when you go in and look at the amount of storage, it says it has 28 gigabytes available because it's calculating using this binary system, this base 2 system. The device actually still has 32 billion bytes of storage, but the OS only reports 28 billion bytes. And so that explains some things, right? Beginning in Snow Leopard, though, on the desktop, Apple changed the way that OS X works to use the base 10 method for calculating storage. So in OS X, things match up. The question is, why hasn't Apple updated iOS devices? I don't really get that. And it obviously causes a lot of confusion, like we heard on the last episode of the MacCast. So I wanted to kind of bring that up. But also, that sort of conversation prompted some other questions in folks' minds, specifically JP, and he sent me this question.
Hey, Adam. This is JP Erickson calling from Los Angeles, California. It's Thanksgiving, which officially means I can wish you a very Merry Christmas. I was just listening to the last episode of the MacCast where a listener was asking about storage space on his, I believe, iPhone. My question for you, though, is I've realized since upgrading to iOS 7 that my messages is taking up the largest amount of information right now. It's up to 2.5 gigabytes. I've gone through and deleted out over probably 3/4 of all the messages that I haven't used in a long time, yet I still can't get that number to come down. I wanted to know if you know anything about that. Why is so much information going to messages? Am I missing something? Where is that hidden? Also, when plugging my iPhone and doing any iTunes Connect or just viewing my iPhone usage on the computer through iTunes, I always see that other category. And Apple has always been very fuzzy when it comes to what the other refers to. Usually it ranges anywhere for me between 3 to at times 6 gigs that it's taking up on my phone. And they can never really answer what that is or where that space is going to. Anyways, man, just wanted to know if you have any insight. Just something to help me sleep easier at night is all I need. Would love to know how I can help clean that up and get some more space on my 16 gig iPhone 5. All right, Adam, thank you so much. Have a great one, man, and happy holidays.
Hey, happy holidays and Merry Christmas to you too, JP. I think I can help you out. I think we can get you sleeping a little bit better at night. This is a common thing that comes up from time to time. I think we've covered it a few times in the past, but no point in not revisiting it. The SMS issue could be a few different things. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that it's very likely, though, attachments. I don't know if you have people who send you photos and things like that. You mentioned you cleaned out the actual messages themselves. That should, when you delete a message that has an attachment from your SMS history, that should also remove that attachment from your device as well. But if you're keeping those, like many of us like to, because we want those images, then those could be what are eating up a lot of your storage in messages. So what you might consider doing is rather than keeping them in messages, go into the messages, tap on the images, save them out to your camera roll, get them out of the messages application, and then delete those SMS messages. Now, there was a bug, if I seem to remember, back in iOS 6, where even deleting the SMS message would leave the attachment behind, and there was really no easy or good way to clear that out. That was supposedly fixed in iOS 6.1. I don't get a lot of messages with attachments, so I haven't really confirmed this, but you might look into that if you're still having this issue, even after removing all of your messages that have photo or video or audio even attachments associated with them. So give that a try. That might help. Now, the other category, everybody always wonders about that other category because it is kind of mysterious, right? It's like, oh, I see I've got music and movies and applications and books, and that all makes sense to me. But what is this other? And it could be a number of things, because the way it works is when you look at the thing called apps, that's really only counting the apps themselves. The data associated with that app, and more specifically, any data that's created as you're using the app, basically your documents and stuff like that, that is what is counted as other. So it's things like cache or offline content or any documents that you saved locally within an application, files and saved game information and data. That all encompasses the other category. And typically, you can see how much each app is using for the other component on your device. I think that's the only way that I know of where you can actually view it on an application-by-application basis. Otherwise, it's sort of all lumped together in that big amorphous other category. But if you go into your device under Settings, General, Usage, and then wait a minute or two for the apps to load under that Storage section, the first number that you'll see next to the application, that's not that other number. That number is actually how much storage the app itself takes up on your device. So that's counted in that app's storage. When you're looking at it in iTunes, that's these apps are using up this much storage. And I think that's where some of the confusion comes in. What you need to do is tap on the actual application itself, and then on the next screen, look at the piece that says Documents and Data. That is a whole separate figure that tells you how much storage the actual application is using up, and that is its part of the other category. So, for example, on my phone, I use Pocket, the application Pocket, and the app itself uses 474 megabytes of storage. But when I go in and look at the Documents and Data figure, I have 446 megabytes of additional data that Pocket is using, other data. And so really the total for Pocket that it's consuming storage-wise on my device is about 920 megabytes, almost a full gigabyte. Yet in that list where it shows me all the applications that are using the most storage, it's way down on the list, even though if it was counted as 920 megabytes, it should be higher. So you really need to think about how the application works. And typically, applications like games that save game data or applications that work a lot with photos or video files, those are going to be eating up a lot of the other storage. So things like iMovie, if you've got video files in there, there could be a lot of storage being eaten up by that. And you can clear that stuff out by going into the applications and deleting the individual files. In some cases, you can actually delete it from the usage section, but also just removing the application completely, that's going to wipe out all of its local data and documents. So that's another way to kind of clean things out if you're not using an application anymore, or just clearing the caches in an application. So for example, that 444 megabytes of data that Pocket is using, that's all the offline content. So when I go access my Pocket account, it pulls down, I have it set up to pull down all the images and things like that for articles so that I can read them if I don't have an internet connection. I could turn that feature off, or I could just clean those articles out, and that would free up some of that storage space. So hopefully with that information, you'll be sleeping better at night, and have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year if we don't hear from you before then. Here's the point in the program where I admit my shame as a quote-unquote power user, because while I know a lot about Macs and applications and things like that, I tend to be a mouser. And what I mean by that is I use my mouse and trackpad almost exclusively for navigation, for getting through applications. I am not at all a power user when it comes to efficiency, when it comes to automation. I do a little bit of automation, but it's really not something I find that I'm good at being habitual about using. And I think when you do that sort of stuff, you do need to kind of be that type of person. So I'm a mouser. There's a lot of people out there that are keyboardists, that rely almost exclusively on the keyboard and keyboard shortcuts for doing all their navigation, getting around. And I watch these people and I am amazed and I am jealous, and I wish, I strive to be one of those people. I just don't think I have the discipline to do it, but they can be much more efficient at it. So I'm always excited when I come across a cool article that shows me how to, or reminds me more accurately, because I know a lot of these shortcuts, reminds me about these keyboard shortcuts. And this week, TUAW had a piece, or it might have been last week, a good piece on Safari keyboard shortcuts. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But I thought I'd cover a couple of those and then give you some tools and hints and tips for maybe becoming more of a keyboard shortcut kind of person. Some of these tools I've used, and again, discipline. It also takes discipline to use these things. But a couple of handy ones. One that I use all the time and do know, Command-T to open up a new tab in the Safari browser. This works actually in Chrome and Firefox. It's pretty much a standard keyboard shortcut for opening up new tabs. But once you have those tabs open, there's some cool things you can do with navigating around between them. Command-Shift and square bracket left or right will allow you to move between open tabs. Also, Command-Shift left arrow or Command-Shift right arrow works exactly the same way. That's one of those ones that I always forget, but would save me a lot of time rather than having to drag my mouse up to the tab and actually click on it. Just hitting Command-Shift left or right arrow will allow you to jump between tabs very, very quickly. If you want to close those tabs, you can hit Command-W so you don't have to go up there and hit the little circle X. Again, being a mouser, that's exactly what I do all the time. Quick one for accessing items in your bookmark bar. That's that little bar that sits right below the URL bar, and you can put things in there. You can access any one of those from a quick shortcut with the number that it is within the list. So the one furthest to the left would be number 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. If you hit Command and the number, that will actually open up that bookmark. So Command 1 would be the first bookmark in your bookmark bar. And that's really handy. And it works for things like the little Java snippets. So actually the first shortcut in my bar is one for adding an article or whatever I'm viewing on the page to my pocket list. So if I hit Command 1 when I'm on a page, it'll automatically add that to my pocket archive, and I can come back and review those articles later. Another really cool one, Alt-Command-L will show you the download list, so you don't have to go up and click on that little arrow. So the TUAW piece has a few more of these and also points out this awesome wiki that I had not heard of before called Shortcut World. It actually has 58 different Safari shortcuts that you can go over and learn, and even more for other programs and applications that you might be using. So that's shortcutworld.com. Again, links in the show notes at maccast.com. But then I also want to remind you about some apps that I mentioned probably years ago on the MacCast that are still good for helping learn keyboard shortcuts, because what they do is they bring up a little overlay, a little sheet within the application that you're working in, and give you hints about what kinds of keyboard shortcuts you can use. And typically they can be assigned to key commands. So one of my favorites, you hold down the command key just for a second or two, and it'll automatically pop up the sheet to kind of give you that suggestion of, hey, here are all the shortcuts you could possibly use at this moment. So the two applications that I like most are one called KeyQ. It's €19.99 from Ergonis software, and the other one is free. It's something called Cheat Sheet. So you might want to check those out if you're looking to get a little more savvy with your keyboard shortcuts. And I just thought that was a great little reminder from the unofficial Apple web blog this week that I wanted to share with you. Accidents happen, right? It's kind of one of these universal truths that things happen, and things happen to our shiny Apple products, and sometimes just odd things. Even, you know, when we're as careful as we possibly can be, you get that one little slip up or just one little freak thing that happens, and you end up with a broken device. And, you know, it may be an older device. Maybe it's no longer under AppleCare. Even if you're diligent about buying the AppleCare Plus or the extended service, you've just worn that out, and now you're past that, and now you have a broken device. And so how do you deal with that? You know, what are some options to deal with that? And what kind of got me thinking about this week was this voicemail that I received from Tobin.
Hi, Adam. This is Tobin from Virginia, longtime listener and MacCast member. I'd like to tell you about an experience I had with a cracked iPhone. My 19-year-old son was recently using his 4S, and he cracked the screen. While this is not unusual, he had only bought it a few months earlier and then cracked the screen just by depressing the power button. I was pretty skeptical, but he swore up and down that he hadn't dropped it. So I called AppleCare, and as expected, I was told that a broken screen voids the phone warranty. So over a few weeks, his screen deteriorated as like cracks in the screen grew. So I purchased a kit from a well-known screen replacement company. Kit came with extensive instructions and a link to a YouTube video on how to replace it. Unfortunately, the instructions in the video just didn't agree. So 4 hours later, after what should have been a 45-minute installation and twice opening the phone and installing the screen, I still couldn't get it to work. So I crammed all the parts back into the case, and while I was at work, my wife brought the phone to the Genius Bar. Now, believe it or not, the concierge told her to ignore any details about what I did to the phone and just tell the Genius Bar engineer simply that the phone was no longer working. Luckily, she thought better of that advice and told the engineer the entire story. The Genius Bar technician checked my AppleCare records and saw that I had made a call about the screen. He said the AppleCare advice I received was not correct. Yes, Apple does not replace screens that have been dropped, at least under warranty, but the Genius Bar technician could tell by the crack pattern that it had not been caused by a drop. He said in 3 years of working at the Genius Bar, he had seen hundreds of people come to him with inoperable iPhones with replaced screens. But for the first time in 3 years, he was going to honor the warranty, and he ended up replacing my son's phone. So I have three morals to the story. Number one, honesty matters. The Genius Bar technician appreciated my efforts to contact AppleCare and to try to get the screen replaced through the proper channels. I think he also appreciated my wife telling the truth. He said when he looked at the phone, it was very obvious that it had been opened and fiddled with. So the advice from the concierge about not saying that was actually really bad. Second moral is do not take no for an answer, and try to use the Genius Bar if you have one nearby. The AppleCare technician who told me the phone wasn't covered just wasn't able to see the phone, but the Genius Bar technician made a different assessment but just by looking at the phone. So always use the Genius Bar whenever possible. Lastly, replace the screen as a last resort. Doing so will more often than not void the warranty. Aftermarket solutions are difficult. The technician said there's a nearby kiosk in the mall that does replacement iPhone screens, but yet he sees a lot of frustrated customers leave there and still are without working iPhones, and they bring it to him, and he really can't do anything for them. Now, I know people have used the same replacement kit I used and were pretty happy with it. However, I'm pretty good with electronics, and I couldn't get the thing to work after 4 hours of messing with it. So you need to replace the screen at your own risk. Pretty much it's your last resort. Anyhow, love the show, Adam. Keep up the great work, and Merry Christmas.
Hey, Merry Christmas, Tobin. And you know what? That is amazing. It's a great story. Some great advice in there. I have never had anyone tell me that their screen was cracked by pressing the power button, but I guess anything is possible. I do have to ask, you're sure your son isn't secretly Superman, right? Your last name's not Kent? Okay, just I had to check on that one first. No, I mean, your advice there is absolutely correct, and I've always said it multiple times on this show, you know, honesty is the best policy. I want to comment on the whole warranty thing and the advice that you were given there. Now, I don't know if this relates or not, but it's always been my understanding, and again, I don't have a policy I can point you to, so this is just my understanding through years of having worked with Apple and Apple products and being in this community, but my understanding has always been that just replacing or having a third-party service or a non-Apple authorized service replace a part either on your Mac, and I would assume this would extend to iOS devices, does not necessarily void the AppleCare warranty. It's my understanding that Apple will not cover the parts that you replaced under warranty anymore, so those specific parts are void. So in other words, if you replace the screen, you come in with a replaced screen that's then cracked and you want Apple to somehow replace that under warranty, that's not going to happen. But other parts that you haven't touched, so say you replaced the screen and then later the home button failed. If you had not replaced the home button, then it's my understanding the home button would still be covered under your original warranty, just not the replacement parts. The other thing is that any damage that you might have done when replacing the screen would not be covered. So if you went in there, replaced the screen, and Apple can tell that as you were replacing the screen, you then damaged the home button, the home button also would not be covered. So user damage or any of those sorts of things are never covered. That would include drops and what have you. Although now with the new AppleCare Plus, you do have the option to have that replaced, you know, just paying the little deductible, which I want to say is $80 now. I can't remember. Apple recently changed the pricing on that. But regardless, you did the right thing, right? You took it in, you had it looked at. And that advice, too, of not necessarily stopping at the first level, that's sometimes a good approach as well. As long as you're polite and upfront and aren't, you know, it's okay to be forceful, just not rude. You know, I know too many people who they're told no, and then they immediately get defensive or aggressive, and I don't think that's the best tact or approach to take. But if you just kindly ask things like, if you don't have a Genius Bar near you, what you could have done is possibly said to the phone support, could I take a screenshot of the crack and send it to you, an image, and at least let you look at it so you have a better idea of what we're dealing with? You know, this is the story. My son said it just cracked when he pressed the power button. The pattern, the crack pattern looks like that's a plausible explanation. So can you just take a look at it? And maybe at that point they would have offered to let you send the device in and at least have it looked at. And whether they would have charged you for that or not probably would depend on the assessment that they made. So you might have to take a little more risk, but you may have had an option there, even if you weren't near a Genius Bar. But absolutely, if you can get in and have somebody look at it, that's the best way to go. It's interesting you mentioned the concierge telling your wife basically not to let on about that damage. I've had that experience in Apple stores as well, where even a Genius or somebody else will recommend that I don't disclose something. I have never found that to be a good policy. Apple will always know. They will always figure it out. I shared my own experience one time when I had sort of done not a jailbreak, but a hack around to do tethering, and I was having problems with my phone. I had forgotten that it was on there. Actually, technically, I restored my phone thinking that, oh, it was back to factory settings, took it in, and the Genius discovered that, you know, and I kind of had to play it off and pretend like, oh, I didn't do anything. No, I don't know how that got on there. Not the best way to go, and I wouldn't advise that to anybody. So always honesty. And the other thing is always give it a shot. Take it in. A lot of people, you know, even with user damage, you drop the phone, something happened, you did something where you think it was your fault. It's worth going in and talking to Apple and see what they say. Worst case scenario, they're going to give you a repair cost and tell you how much it's going to cost. It's going to cost you a little bit of time, but the flip side is sometimes they just go above and beyond and they cover the device, sort of like the experience you had. So I think that's really, really great. The other thing is, and we brought this up on the MacCast as well, Apple does have a pretty clear out-of-warranty repair cost policy, and you can get the details and information on their website. So even if you had gone in and they said, look, that's user damage, we're not going to cover the replacement of that screen, or you try to replace it yourself, we're not going to cover that screen, there are fixed costs that sort of lower, you know, how much you're going to have to pay to get that thing replaced. On an iPhone 5S, 5C, or 5, for example, almost any repair out of warranty is a flat fee of $269, $199 for an iPhone 4S and $149 for an iPhone 4, 3GS, or iPhone 3G, even an original iPhone. Now, you have to make an assessment, is it worth it or not to do that, but those are the flat costs for like major damage. The only caveat there is they will not repair what they call catastrophic damage. Basically, if you bring in an iPhone and it's in 10 pieces, they're not even going to cover that under out of warranty. But if it's a cracked screen, something like that, you probably can get a replacement for the flat fee costs. And even some of the smaller components and things like that, those repairs can sometimes be a little bit less. Now that they're doing more stuff in store, I think some of those costs are coming down and those fixed costs will be adjusting. So it's always worth asking, I think, you know, at least you know what you're up against. And then if you do want to go with a third party, that works too, especially if you have an out-of-warranty device and you don't think you can get it repaired. I have done that myself. I've used parts from Tech Restore, so hopefully that's not the known company that you got your parts from, because they have done a pretty good job for me in the past. I was able to get in there and do the repairs myself. Now, I think they do have videos on their site. I'm not sure that I ever used their videos because, in my opinion, if you're going to do a DIY repair on a Mac or Apple product, you probably want to use the guides over at ifixit.com. These guys are amazing. They have all the tools that you need to help with the repair. And a lot of doing these repairs yourself is all about having the right tools, the right spludgers and things like that to be actually be able to get in there and get the device apart. And you have to be very careful and methodical. It is a tricky process. I'm pretty technical myself, and you know, it took me several hours to replace the screen on my iPhone 3GS, but I was able to actually do it successfully. And with practice, you get sort of better and better at it. So if you don't want to go that far, there are some pretty good repair services. Again, Tech Restore, I think, is a great one. They have an overnight service. They do a really nice job. I've sent other people I know there, and they've been very happy with the results. So you can check that out at techrestore.com. And then I guess another option always is, if you don't want to go with AppleCare Plus, you have third-party warranty services like SquareTrade, and they cover your devices against accidental damage. Often they'll even let you get the repairs done at Apple, just pay Apple's costs, and then they will reimburse you. And I know that many of you also have recommended that, you know, you have credit cards sometimes where you get accidental damage protection just by using the card. And I know some people have some of those. I've heard they can be sometimes tricky to actually collect on that service. So read the fine print and find out exactly what's covered and what's not. If you're depending upon one of those, you know where you're at. But you definitely have some options. And Tobin, absolutely great advice, and thanks for sharing your story. MacCast listener Susan wrote me, and she was having this odd mail issue in OS X Mavericks. And what was going on was, even though she had set her mail account to check for new mail manually, she was noticing that it would continually still pull in new email almost as if on a schedule. I think she was using pop email, so it should only check according to the settings that you set up in Mail. If you have an IMAP account, I think you can set the setting to manual in the Mail preferences, but in some instances, depending upon how your server is, you may still get email being pushed from the server. I've read one possible way to stop IMAP from actually pushing is to make sure to uncheck the use idle command if the server supports it option in the advanced settings of the mail preferences for the IMAP account. So you go into the account and then go into that advanced tab, and you should find that setting there. But Susan and I went back and forth on a few emails, and at the end of it, I was completely stumped. I had no idea why this wasn't working for her. Luckily, she was able to figure it out and follow it up, because it turns out this wasn't actually an OS X Mavericks related issue at all, but actually related to a completely other feature, and one that you may or may not expect. What she discovered was that if she turned off the new power nap feature in Mac OS X, mail no longer would go out and get any of the messages automatically. So it seemed that power nap would go out and get mail. If mail was left open, power nap would actually go out on a schedule and check for new messages, regardless of the setting in mail. And I was actually, once I had that information, I was actually able to find an Apple support article on power nap that explained exactly what Susan was experiencing. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically it says, mail and notes, if they're running, contacts, calendars, reminders, photo stream, find my Mac, and iCloud documents are all checked every hour. So that would be every hour, I'm assuming, regardless of any setting that you set in the Mail app itself. It also notes that you do need to leave the Mail and Notes applications open and running when your Mac enters the PowerNap mode for it to actually do that checking. And I confirmed with Susan, she actually does, like many of us, leave Mail open all the time. And so that is exactly what was happening. So in this case, I guess in some ways it's a feature, but it would seem that PowerNap and your mail settings are a little bit in conflict at that point, because if you want to only absolutely check your mail manually, then suddenly you can't use the PowerNap features. There's some other scheduled tasks that were noted in that Apple support article that are also worth mentioning. Time Machine backups are actually attempted every hour or hourly until a successful backup has been completed when you're in PowerNap mode. Software updates are checked daily, and Mac App Store downloads are checked once per week when using PowerNap. So just be aware of those schedules as well. Because this comes into bandwidth. I know some people who are in regions where they have to pay for extra bandwidth. And if you've got, you know, a lot of big software updates happening automatically, maybe you don't want that going on when your Mac's asleep. You want to know specifically when that might be happening. So the article has a full list of all the things that are going to still happen on your Mac when PowerNap mode is enabled, and also points out that some tasks like downloading software updates or running Time Machine backups will only happen if you are plugged in and connected to AC power. So if you're on battery, it's not going to do that. Another thing to note is that PowerNap will actually silence alerts and disable lights, system sounds, and fans when it's active. So fans are only disabled on flash storage and not Fusion Drive-based Macs, so you need to have a Mac where the fan's not going to be, you know, critical to the cooling of the system. If you have a spindle-based drive in your Mac, it's that feature, it sounds like, will still work. But also, if you use the play sound or send message feature of Find My Mac, PowerNap will not make any sound, and that is not good. So, PowerNap has a lot of nice features, but it would bother me that if I want to use Find My Mac and I want to send an alert sound or a message saying, hey, if lost, please found, using Find My Mac, well, that's suddenly, you know, disabled, or the sound's not going to come up. So somebody's going to have to actually open up the Mac and actually see that message. So in my mind, it makes feature like Find My Mac a little less useful. Now, the main idea behind PowerNap is that your Mac will still be able to do all these specific tasks while sleeping and do it in a way that's really energy efficient, doesn't run down your battery when you're not using it, so saves on power consumption on your Mac, but still allows it to run these kind of background tasks. And the article has a full list of Macs that are compatible with PowerNap. In case you're wondering, it's basically MacBook Airs, most of the MacBook Air models, as near as I can tell, Retina Mac Pros, and the late 2012 iMac models, along with the late 2012 Mac Mini. And if you're running a desktop Mac, it does require OS X Mavericks to have the PowerNap feature. It was added in Mavericks for desktop Macs. It's been there since, I think, Mountain Lion for the notebooks. And the article does also note some differences in how PowerNap works when your battery starts to get low, depending upon the Mac model that you have. So notebooks with a 2013 or later year model in their name use PowerNap until the battery is drained all the way down. So PowerNap will continue to work regardless. If you have a notebook that's 2012 or earlier, then it will suspend PowerNap operations if the battery has a charge of 30% or less. And then they will resume again once you've connected to a power adapter. If you look at all this stuff and you decide, hey, you know what, I really don't want PowerNap enabled, you can actually turn it off in the Energy Saver System Preferences if you have a supported Mac. So just go into System Preferences under Energy Saver and then uncheck the Enable PowerNap button. Set that to off, and I believe it's enabled by default on any supported Mac. So if you've never gone in and looked at that setting, you probably want to double check it. And then on notebooks, so that's for desktop Macs. On notebooks, it's actually found under the battery tab. So still in the same price, System Preferences, Energy Saver, but you need to make sure you go into the battery tab to see the little checkbox, and you'll find it there. Apple also mentions that if your Mac is running on battery power and you want to optimize PowerNap, you want to disconnect any bus-powered external devices, things like hard drives or storage devices. But, you know, really, who's going to do that? I don't think that's very realistic. But regardless, the article is probably worth taking a look at. And big thanks to you, Susan, for figuring out what was going on here and pointing me to the right solution so that we could share that with the community. And then the last item I have for you, on the last show, I had someone who was asking about a way to replace the gray full screen background that shows up in OS X Mavericks. It's linen in Mountain Lion, that gray background that shows up on your inactive screen when you're playing a application in full screen mode. Now, Mavericks has the new, you know, thing where you can have multiple windows on multiple screens, but I'm talking about if you've put it back into the mode like it was in Mountain Lion, you get the blank screen and then you have the one screen with the full screen mode. And the reason that he wanted to change it was he watches, he has it hooked up to a HD television and uses that to watch content full screen from Safari. But if you're watching a movie or something like that, you have that bright screen of your other Mac in the same room, and it's, you know, giving off quite a bit of light, even with that just dark gray background, and he wanted to change that to black. And I could find a way to do that in Mountain Lion by hacking the dock app that's in the core services, but that trick no longer works in OS X Mavericks. It doesn't have the same files and information. And I got excited this week when I saw a solution on Cult of Mac. They posted an article that linked to a piece on OS X Daily. I'll have a link to the full piece in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to try this out. But it covered a way to change the OS X Mavericks wallpaper on the login screen. So when you come up to the login screen, it's got the Apple logo and it asks you to put in your password. You can change the background of that screen. And with Mountain Lion, when you changed the screen for the full screen mode, it also changed, gave you the same background, basically, on dashboard and also in mission control. So it was kind of a universal thing. I tried this little trick in Mavericks, and it, as near as I can tell, only changed the login screen. So I don't know how, for the life of me, you change that gray background in OS X Mavericks, that default gray background. But this is still a cool tip. So if you're not timid about totally hacking the core of your system and possibly completely breaking your operating system, then you can follow along and try this out. But the trick actually technically doesn't replace the gray background. What it does is it actually covers up the background because you're replacing the little Apple logo that's actually a transparent PNG file with a big giant piece of wallpaper. So you're replacing that file and it's basically covering up the gray background. It also means that you're going to replace your Apple logo. So you probably want to build in your own kind of little logo or whatever you have, whatever you want, you know, layered in on top of your file. Again, the article goes into the details about all of this stuff, but in essence, you want to create a big PNG, the full resolution of your Mac's display. So whatever, you know, the max resolution of your screen is, create a file that size, and then you're going to make four copies of it and rename them, giving them some exact names. And those are detailed in the article. And then once you have your four PNG files all prepped and ready, you're going to go into the Finder under the Go menu and choose Go to Folder. And then you're going to go to this really, you know, deep in the system place. This is where it gets a little bit frightening. You go into System, Library, Private Frameworks, into the Login UIKit.framework folder, inside Versions, inside a folder called Simply A, inside a folder called Frameworks, and then into the Login UIKore.framework folder, and then into Resources. And then you'll find these four little PNG files, all called Apple.png, Apple_S1.png, et cetera, et cetera. And you'll find these four files. And so what you probably want to do before doing anything is select the four files that are already in the system folder and hold down the Option key and drag them out into the Finder, put them someplace safe and back them up. Also, I figure it should have gone without saying, but I'll tell you right now, before you try any of this, make sure you have a full backup of your system, because seriously, if you do something wrong deep inside this part of the system, you could potentially, you know, break your Mac, stop it from booting up, you know, not hardware damage, but you might seriously mess up the operating system. So back up your entire system and then back up these four little files in case you want to restore and get everything back to normal. But once you've backed those up, then what you can do is you can drag in and replace those with your versions, your big desktop background. And you'll probably have to enter your admin credentials because this is a protected folder and within the OS X permissions, but plug that information in. It'll copy those files in. And then when you log out of your account, you should see the new paper wallpaper on your login screen. So you can have, you know, a big, old, nice image of the beach or something like that when you log in every time on your Mac. So cool little hack, a little bit hairy, not too extreme if you're not faint of heart, but wanted to share that with you. And if anybody still, we're looking, anybody knows how to change that gray, dark gray background to a different color, black, I'm assuming it's probably something in a property list file. It's probably some little setting that you have to tweak somewhere within the system. If anybody can discover and figure out where that is, let us know, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a final moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with their new application, PDF Pen Scan Plus. Check them all out. Get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Transporter by Connected Data. You can get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control, security, and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. You can check out all the Transporter products and get 10% off your own Transporter by using the coupon code MACCAST. Just head over to filetransporter.com/MACCAST to check out all the details. And Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. If you have a comment, a question for me, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can send audio comments and emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype if you want to avoid some long-distance charges. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you call on there, it'll just ring through to a voicemail and you can just leave your message. I think with both voicemail systems, I should also mention, I think there's kind of a time limit between 1.5 and 3 minutes, so you might need to keep it brief, or if you have something particularly long to say, just note that you might have to leave two voicemails. And it's fine. I can stitch them together. Don't worry about it. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can check those out on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum, a really great place to get answers to your questions and help between shows. So if you don't want to wait around for me to cover your question or topic in the next episode, you can get some help from the community over on the forum. And it's free to sign up. Forum.maccast.com is where you can find that. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, you can do that. Twitter is twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. You can also check out the Google+ community. Just search for MacCast on Google+. And basically what goes on there is I post little cool things that I find. Like this week, it was the whole Morgan Freeman thing. I don't know if you've seen that, but there's a guy, he does a drawing on his iPad using the app Procreate of Morgan Freeman that looks like a photo when it's finished, and it's amazing. There's a video that shows you all the step-by-step process. I think it like took like 200 hours. Forget how many strokes, and he did it all with his finger on an iPad. Amazing, amazing stuff. So when I find those sorts of things, I try and share those out there. So if you'd like to follow me in any of those locations, you're gonna get that content and be hopefully quick to know. I won't say first to know because a lot of people beat me to these things. I don't know how people find all this cool stuff. Who has time? Anyway, that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.